My name is Sharon Walmsley, and I'm from the University of Toronto in Canada, and I'm pleased with my co-moderator, Dr. Pedro Kahn from Argentina, to welcome you to this session on newer antiretroviral agents. I think we will all agree that the management of HIV-infected patients over the past and then finally, we will learn something about the development of resistance and the impairment that that can cause in the absence of routine resistance testing. So I think we're in for a very exciting session. Our speakers will each have 10 minutes, followed by 5 minutes for questions. We will welcome you to come to the microphone, state your name and where you're from, and please try and keep your questions short so that we can make sure that we can involve everyone. So without further ado, we will start this morning's session. The first paper will be presented by Marty Markowitz. It is entitled Sustained Antiviral Efficacy of Raltegravir as Part of Combination ART in Treatment-Naive HIV-Infected Patients, the 96-week data. Welcome, Marty.
Thanks, Sharon. Buenos dias a todos. Okay, good morning. It's my pleasure on behalf of my co-investigators in Merck Laboratories to present the 96-week data on Merck Study 004, which looked at the activity of raltegravir in combination with tenofovir and 3TC in comparison to that NUC backbone with efavirenz. As most of you now know, raltegravir is a potent strand transfer inhibitor of HIV integrase. It is potent in the nanomolar range, and it has activity against a broad range of HIV isolates. Protocol 004 had a rather unique two-part design. The first part was a proof-of-concept monotherapy study, which was then followed by a lead-in, where raltegravir at four doses, 100, 200, 400, and 600 milligrams in combination with tenofovir and 3TC, was compared with efavirenz plus tenofovir and 3TC, the hypothesis being that raltegravir in combination with the NUC backbone would be well tolerated and show similar antiretroviral activity. The endpoints are shown here, and you've heard me in the past present 24 and 48-week data, and these data have been published in the Journal of AIDS. Today I will present 96-week data. Please note that following 48 weeks, all four dose ranges of raltegravir were combined into a 400 milligram twice daily dose without regard to food, and therefore I will present the data in that manner. So it's one single group of 160 patients. Baseline characteristics are shown here, and as you can see, the patient characteristics are well balanced, about 80% men, approximately 70% of the population non-white, baseline RNA about 4.8 log, approximately one-third of the cohort had an AIDS diagnosis, and please note that despite 96 weeks of therapy, there was only approximately a 15% dropout in this particular study, which speaks, I think, to the tolerability of both regimens. This is the primary endpoint, percent of patients with HIV RNA values less than 400 copies, a non-complete or equal failure, and you can see here that at 96 weeks, both groups are identical, with 84% of the cohort being undetectable. Please note that using an observed failure approach, in the raltegravir arm, 94% of the patients were below detection compared to the efavirenz arm, 91%. Looking at the 50 copy assay, again, almost superimposable results at 96 weeks with 83% of the raltegravir patients below detection and 84% of the efavirenz patients below detection. Again, on an observed failure approach, 92% versus 91%. Concomitant with the reduction of viral load shown in the bottom half of this slide, about 2.3 log, is an approximately 200-plus CD4 cell count increase, demonstrating that with virologic control in both arms, there is a concomitant improvement in immunological status. During the second 48 weeks of this study, two patients did have virologic failure and both baseline and genotype analyses at failure. Please note the one patient in the raltegravir arm that met criteria for virological failure based on relapse, meaning the patient went below 400 and then was at least one log above 400 copies, that patient had a completely wild-type genotype. Note that the patient who relapsed on the efavirenz had the expected M184V and the resistant mutations consistent with efavirenz exposure. The overall adverse event profiles were similar between raltegravir and efavirenz. Drug-related adverse events were 51% in the raltegravir arm versus 74% in the efavirenz arms, and these are any adverse event reported by investigators. Please note that the major imbalance in adverse events were neuropsychiatric symptoms. Most occurred early on by 48 weeks, 13% in the raltegravir arm versus 29% in the efavirenz arm at week 48. And these persisted, 16% in the raltegravir arm and 32% in the efavirenz arm at week 96. Of note and importantly, the rate of malignancies in the raltegravir arm and the efavirenz arm were identical. Grade 3 and 4 laboratory abnormalities were uncommon, and I will show you those data shortly, and raltegravir had a neutral effect on serum lipid profiles. These are the most common drug-related adverse events as reported by investigators. As you can see, diarrhea, nausea are rather the same in both treatment arms. The difference between the arms really is dizziness, headache, abnormal dreams and nightmares, and this predominates in the efavirenz arm. Grade 3 and 4 laboratory abnormalities were relatively rare in both arms. I will call your attention to the fact that there were 10 reports of grade 4 elevations of CPK in the raltegravir arm compared to 1 in the efavirenz arm. The effect on serum lipids is shown in this slide. As I told you earlier, the effects on serum lipids in the raltegravir arm were essentially neutral with no significant changes over time in the positive direction after raltegravir exposure. The changes in cholesterol, LDL, and HDL are statistically significantly different in the efavirenz arm when compared to raltegravir arm, and the p-values are shown in the final column. In summary, at 96 weeks, raltegravir had sustained antiretroviral effect similar to the 48-week data and to efavirenz in combination with tenofovir and 3TC. Approximately 84% of the patients had viral loads below the level of detection. We did not detect raltegravir mutations after 48 weeks, and raltegravir was generally well tolerated at 96 weeks. Drug-related adverse events appeared less frequent for raltegravir versus efavirenz, and this was predominantly in the area of neuropsychiatric complaints. Raltegravir had a neutral effect on total cholesterol, LDL, and triglycerides. And I'd like to acknowledge the fact that this was a large study done internationally, my co-investigators, and of course the team at Merck Research Laboratories. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Marty. This paper is now open for questions. I believe there are two microphones. In the corridors? In the main, we can't see them from here. Perhaps I will start with the first one, Marty, while people are trying to find the microphones. There was some discussion as to the more rapid virologic suppression in the raltegravir arms at the earlier cuts of this data. It would appear now that the two drugs are performing the same. Do you think that that more rapid decrease in viral load has any clinical importance?
Sharon, I think that's a very important question, and the difference may really reflect mechanism as opposed to inherent antiviral activity based on, however, I will caution you in that in most studies, the early events are true measures of antiviral potency, and the longer events are really a combination of adherence, et cetera. So we still don't know what the clinical significance of those differences are. An excellent paper appeared in AIDS last year by John Murray, and for those interested, I would urge you to read it. And indeed, the difference in mechanism really might be responsible.
Mark?
Mark Weinberg, McGill University, Montreal. Marty, very interesting talk, but you said that the relapsed patient on raltegravir did not have mutations at 48 weeks. When will we know what's happening between 48 weeks and later time points in regard to monitoring for resistance mutations in this cohort?
Okay, I'm sorry if I didn't make myself clear. There was one patient who relapsed between 48 weeks and 96 weeks on the raltegravir arm that had paired samples, and that patient had wild-type virus by genotype. None of the other patients met virologic criteria, so any of the dropout, any of the failures were for other reasons.
Thank you.
Is there a question on this microphone?
Yeah. Yes. Moji Adeyeye from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Is there a plan to do pediatric studies on this drug?
I don't represent Merck Research Laboratories. However, I do know that as part of their research plan, there is a pediatric program in progress.
Okay, Mike, last question to you.
Mike Yule, so not representing Merck Research Laboratories, put your clinical hat on and say, why wouldn't you drop the dose? Because there's no evidence there was any difference in the difference between those people who received lower doses in the first period. And as we know, that's the likely period when resistance is going to develop. And a subpart to the question is, do you think that it's logical now to do a randomization of those people on raltegravir to once daily?
Mike, I think you've asked a very good question, and let me just speak on behalf of the Merck team, since I'm privy to some of the decisions that were made. First of all, the 400 milligram dose was selected on the basis of lots and lots of PK data, and raltegravir is an interesting drug in that there's a huge amount of variability within the same person and from person to person. And to try to ensure that the vast majority of patients are receiving exposures that would appear to be consistent with a good virologic response, the 400 milligram dose was chosen. Also, in light of the fact that raltegravir exposures are substantially reduced by certain drugs such as rifampin and tipranovir. Now, again, remember that the development plan for raltegravir really focused on the treatment-experienced population, and this is the treatment-naive population. It's rare in HIV that we've actually developed drugs with different dosing plans for different patient populations. However, I think that's an interesting thought and one that certainly should be thought about for raltegravir, perhaps, and other drugs, particularly as we try to roll some of these drugs out to less developed areas. I think that based on what we know about raltegravir exposures, the 200 BID exposure is probably similar to what one would expect with a QD exposure at 800 milligrams daily. So that is on the menu, so to speak, for further development plans.
Great. Thanks, Marty. So we'll look to further studies with this compound. We will move on to the second paper of this session. paper 103, entitled TMC-278 Rilpivirine, a Next Generation NNRTI, Demonstrates Long-Term Efficacy and Tolerability in Antiretroviral Naive Patients. The 96-week data from study C-204, which will be presented by Mario Santoscavi on behalf of his co-investigators. Mario, welcome.
Thank you, Sharon. Good morning to everyone. On behalf of study C-204 investigators, it is my pleasure to present the following 96-week efficacy, safety, and tolerability data of TMC-278 rilpivirine. TMC-278 is a next-generation NNRTI with potent anti-HIV activity against wild-type and resistant virus with favorable PK. 48-week analysis demonstrated that three TMC-278 QD doses provided potent, sustained efficacy in treatment-naive patients and were well-tolerated. TMC-278 is currently in phase 3 trials. C-204 study is an ongoing, multinational, phase 2B, randomized, controlled, dose-ranging study in 368 antiretroviral-naive patients with a baseline viral load equal or higher than 5,000 copies per mil and no NNRTI mutations. Its primary objective was to evaluate the efficacy and safety dose-response relationship of three blinded TMC-278 doses, 25, 75, and 150 milligram QD at 48 weeks. An open-label active control, efavirenz 600 milligrams QD, was included for comparison. Randomization was stratified by world region and by investigator-selected NRTI backbone, either ACT-3TC or tenofovir-FTC. Demographic and baseline characteristics were well-balanced across treatment groups. 33% of subjects were females. 75% of patients initiated ACT-3TC, while 25% tenofovir-FTC. While the median viral load was similar across treatment groups, there was an imbalance in the proportion of patients with very high baseline viral load, more than 300K copies per mil, 11% for efavirenz patients and 23 to 26% for TMC-278 patients. With respect to efficacy, no significant differences were observed among TMC-278 dose groups or in comparison with efavirenz at each time point. A tricyclic divergence of response rates to TMC-278 and efavirenz between weeks 16 and 32 could partly be explained by an imbalance in the proportion of patients with very high baseline viral loads, as just mentioned. This slide shows week 48 data, because it was the primary endpoint of the trial. The proportion of patients with undetectable viral loads were well maintained from week 48 to 96. At week 96, 71 to 76% of patients in the TMC-278 groups, compared with 71% of patients in the efavirenz group, had confirmed viral loads less than 50 copies per mil. No clear TMC-278 dose-response relationship was observed. The proportion of virologic failures across treatment groups was low and not statistically significantly different among TMC-278 doses groups or efavirenz at weeks 48 nor 96. Overall discontinuations were comparable between TMC278 dose groups and efavirenz. Mean change from baseline in CD4 cell count through weeks 48 and 96 was similar among TMC278 groups and comparable to efavirenz, with no statistically significant differences. Mean change from baseline in CD4 cell count at week 96 further increased compared with week 48. Regarding resistance data, very few patients experience virologic failure with resistance-associated mutations. 17 patients in the TMC278 arms, 6 patients in the efavirenz arms. Thus, definitive conclusions about the resistance profile of TMC278 could not be drawn from this study. The proportion of patients in whom treatment-emergent NNRTI-associated mutations developed was similar across arms. In genotype subjects, mutations arise about in 50% in each treatment arm. Resistance findings will be further explored in phase 3 trials, which will include a much larger sample of patients, around 600 per arm. There was no notable increase in adverse events since week 48. The incidences of any adverse event, any serious adverse events, any grade 3 or 4 adverse events, and grade 3 or 4 lab abnormalities were similar between all TMC278 group compared to efavirenz. Investigations reported as grade 3 or 4 adverse events were the principal cause for discontinuation in the TMC278 combined group, while no efavirenz patient was discontinued due to this. Analysis of specific safety data, where I believe clearly the real differences between TMC278 and efavirenz lie, show the following. Firstly, frequency of rashes, any grade, was lower for TMC278 than for efavirenz, 9% versus 21% respectively, difference statistically significant. Secondly, nervous system disorders occurred in 31% of TMC278 treated patients versus 48% of efavirenz treated patients. Again, with a statistically significant difference, especially regarding dizziness and, to a lesser degree, somnolence. Thirdly, psychiatric disorders were reported at similar incidence in the three TMC278 dose groups and at a lower incidence than with efavirenz. Only the frequency of abnormal dreams was statistically significantly lower for TMC278 treated patients. There was a clear increase from baseline for total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, and triglycerides for the efavirenz group. This difference with TMC278 combined group was statistically significant. There was no increase in total cholesterol, LDL, or triglycerides for any of the TMC278 dose groups. There was an increase in HDL cholesterol for all TMC278 dose groups, which was not as great as in the efavirenz group. Additional endocrine investigations were undertaken because of preclinical studies data. However, no clinical relevant changes in adrenal and thyroid parameters were observed. As for ECGs, these were done as part of routine safety monitoring. Increases in QTC interval we've seen with all TMC278 doses and efavirenz up to 48 weeks, which then stabilized up to week 96. Increases were primarily seen with the ACT-3TC backbone. Mean increase was lowest with TMC278 25 milligrams. In conclusion, once daily oral TMC278 at all doses demonstrated a high response rate and sustained virologic response over 96 weeks. TMC278 was generally safe and well tolerated. Incidences of rash, nervous system, and psychiatric-related adverse events and increase in lipids were significantly lower with TMC278 than with efavirenz. There were trends suggesting a favorable profile of TMC278 25 milligrams compared with the higher dose groups. Both efficacy and safety of TMC278 were well maintained between 48 and 96 weeks. TMC278 is being further evaluated in phase 3 trials at a dose of 25 milligrams QD. And finally, to acknowledge the authors, would like to thank all the patients who participated in the study, study center staff, DSMB members, Tibotex study personnel, and the following principal investigators. Thank you.
Thank you, Mario. This paper is open for questions. First, I'd like just clarification, Mario, on the QT prolongation. Did you imply that there were no more cases of QT prolongation after week 48, or it was the length of the QT that was not longer after 48 weeks?
What I meant was to say that the prolongation did stabilize between 48 and 96 weeks. I didn't show the graph, which clearly shows a steeper line between baseline and 48 weeks, and then a much less steeper line until 96 weeks for all groups. That's what I meant.
Joe?
Yeah, hi, Joe Iran from Chapel Hill. Could you please tell us what the rilpivirine resistance mutations were?
Well, as I have told, no definitive conclusions could be drawn from this small number of patients' viral failures at this study. There were 9 patients with resistance-associated mutations, very small. I believe we cannot say with any certainty which and how many mutations are sufficient to confer resistance to TMC278.
Well, I think it's reasonable just to tell us what they are, don't you think?
Well, yeah. For the majority of these 9 patients, there were 184B mutations found. As for NNRTI mutations, there were also some of these patients found with 138K mutation.
Thanks.
Mike?
I see that Tibotec are continuing to do their don't tell us the resistance data until later scenario, which I would argue that was a bad idea. Either I was asleep, which probably could have been true, or I missed the fact that since there was no difference in the total adverse events between the two, between the four arms, that if you had a significant difference in some of the adverse events, then what were the trends to worse adverse events for the TMC278 arms? So even though you acknowledge this is a small study, and it is, what were the things in the TMC278 arms that were more frequent within adverse events? Was it hematologic changes or others? Because it must account for the balance.
Yeah, I would say that the patients with the 150 milligram TMC278 dose were found with higher incidence of adverse events, like say, in general. Likewise, I would say the same for 75 milligrams. 75 milligram dosing was used since week 48 until now, recently, from week until now, week 144 has been changed to a 25 milligram dosing.
I don't know if I answered your question.
I think it's always good to be more honest about the results in earlier studies, because then it allows us to understand what's going to happen in later studies. Thank you.
Okay, last question at this microphone.
Hi. Yeah, it's a bit more of a comment. I'm encouraged to see this drug go through. I'm really interested in drugs that can take the place of favarins, and I just want to say that in collecting the data in the adverse events, we need more accurate reporting of what those adverse events are. 50% of the people who take efavirenz have a really difficult time, and that's not dizziness. It's suicidal. It's I can't finish my thoughts. I can't look after myself. I can't work. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes in there, and I just see in this conference people obsessed by Sestiva or efavirenz, and so much so I had to walk out the other day because everyone wanted a tripla. I don't want convenient HIV. I want effective drugs that don't have side effects that make me go crazy. So when we need to get these drugs paid for, those are the arguments we need to make, and we need that captured in the data. And if you're not doing that, you make our job very hard.
Okay, I think we would all agree that we're happy to have new agents. I think we all look forward to see more details on, A, the resistance profile and what are the main NNRTI mutations with this compound, as well as a clarification of the adverse event profile. So I'll now turn the chair over to Pedro, again from Argentina, Buenos Aires, and our outgoing IAS president to chair the second half of this symposium.
Thank you, Sharon. Our next paper will be a prospective randomized open-label trial of efavirenz versus lopinavir ritonavir-based HART among antiretroviral therapy-naive HIV-infected individuals presenting for care with CD4 cell counts, and that's it. That's the title, from Juan Sierra Madero and co-workers here in Mexico.
Thank you. I would like to thank the organizers for allowing me to present this data today on behalf of my colleagues and co-authors. And this is a 48-week analysis of an open-label randomized trial conducted in multiple sites in Mexico to evaluate the virological efficacy of two regimens in HIV-infected subjects who are naive to antiretrovirals and who present to care with very low CD4 counts. And in developing countries, including Mexico and in many areas of the developed world, the most common form of presentation to care of HIV-infected individuals is with advanced disease, defined as those patients who present with an AIDS-defining event or CD4 counts less than 200. In fact, in a recent study presented at this conference yesterday, 74% of patients from different Latin American countries had a CD4 count below 200 when beginning therapy. In that study, the number for the only center evaluated from Mexico was close to 80%. This is important because very low CD4 counts at baseline have been consistently associated with poor virological and clinical outcomes to HART in different studies. And even though many antiretroviral trials in naive subjects have included sub-analysis for efficacy in patients with very low CD4 counts, few studies that directly compare regimens in this difficult-to-treat population exist. Current treatment guidelines are based in studies in which most of the patients do not have advanced disease. So according to the most recent treatment guidelines in many parts of the world, including those from DHHS and Mexico, the options to start treatment are either efavirenz or a boosted PI in combination with two nucleosides. Until last year, the Mexican guidelines recommended a boosted PI as the third component of an initial regimen for patients with CD4 counts lower than 100. And few studies have compared the efavirenz regimen versus boosted PIs. One such study is the recently published ACTG 5142 trial, which compared lopinavir-ritonavir versus efavirenz in treatment-naive subjects. Of note, the median CD4 values at baseline in this study were well above 100 and close to 200, and approximately only one-third of patients in each group had CD4 counts less than 100. So the primary objective of our study was to demonstrate non-inferiority of efavirenz versus lopinavir ritonavir in antiretroviral naive individuals with CD4 counts less than 200, and the primary endpoint was the proportion of subjects with less than 50 copies at week 48, and secondary endpoints were changes in CD4, lipids, and safety. The study was conducted in 11 sites in Mexico. The blue stars indicate the location of the sites outside Mexico City. Many of these sites attend to rural and marginalized population. The states in red are those with the highest prevalence of HIV in the country, and the coordinating center was located in Mexico City. The study was registered in the clinical trial website, and methodological support was provided by the BC Center for Excellence for AIDS in Vancouver. The study was an open label, randomized, and included treatment-naive HIV-infected subjects whose CD4 counts at baseline were less than 200. There were 264 patients screened and 189 randomized one-to-one to receive efavirenz or lopinavir ritonavir in combination with a fixed dose combination of ACT and 3TC. There were 75 screening failures, and among the reasons for these failures were patients having CD4 values higher than the inclusion criteria, deaths during the screening period, TB, and withdrawal of consent. For the randomization process, the patients were stratified according to CD4 values below or above 100. Patients who developed intolerance or anemia with ACT were allowed to substitute for abacavir and continue the study, and there were 6 patients in the efavirenz group and 8 in the lopinavir group who substituted during the study. The laboratory evaluations were done at baseline and weeks 8, 24, 32, and 48. Virological failure was defined as a confirmed presence of HIV RNA above 50 copies after 6 months in the study, or at 8 weeks failure to decline more than one log. The primary endpoint was the proportion of patients with HIV RNA less than 50 copies at 48 weeks, using the time-to-loss virologic response algorithm. The non-inferiority hypothesis was confirmed if the lower limit of 95% confidence interval of the difference between groups in virologic response is higher than minus 12. So the baseline characteristics of the patients are shown in this table. The proportion of women participating in the study is similar to the proportion of women with HIV in Mexico, as shown by the median value of CD4, which is 64 and 52, and by the proportion of patients with CD4 counts that had lower than 50, which was almost 50%, this is clearly a very advanced group of patients. More than 80% of the patients had a viral load higher than 75,000 copies. This table shows the patient disposition at week 48. The reasons for discontinuation from the study are shown here. Virological failure was more common in patients receiving lopinavir. Discontinuation for adverse events were more common in the lopinavir group also, but not statistically significant. And among the adverse events leading to discontinuation, there were 7 deaths and 3 patients who developed tuberculosis after treatment initiation. There were 16 and 12% of patients who were considered lost to follow-up or who abandoned the study. So using the 50-copy limit of detection assay by intent-to-treat analysis shown in continuous lines here, 70% and 53% of patients were undetectable in the efavirenz and lopinavir-ritonavir groups respectively. The difference between the groups is 17% and meets the criteria for non-inferiority and also for superior efficacy. The difference was also significant in the as-treated analysis shown in dotted lines. A post-hoc sub-analysis of those patients who started treatment with less than 50 cells showed a significantly higher proportion of patients reaching 48 weeks with less than 50 copies in the efavirenz group than in the lopinavir group. Using the 400-copy assay by intent-to-treat analysis, the proportion of patients who had undetectable viral load was 73% and 65% in the efavirenz and lopinavir groups respectively, and this difference is not statistically significant. In the as-treated analysis, the proportion was 88 and 75, and this difference was significant. CD4 values increased throughout the study in both groups. At 48 weeks, the increase in CD4 counts was similar, with an average of 150 cells. Genotypes were available on a portion of those patients who failed. All three genotypes in patients with experiencing failure on the Fabry's group had mutations, whereas only one in the five patients in the lopinavir group had an NRTI mutation. This slide shows the change in lipids at week 48 from baseline. The change in total cholesterol, high-density cholesterol, and low-density cholesterol were no different, but change in triglycerides was significantly higher in the lopinavir-ritonavir group. During the trial, serious adverse events occurred in similar proportions in both groups. Most of these were opportunistic infections leading to hospitalization and death. Among the grade 2 to 4 adverse events experienced, as expected, CNS disorders were more common in the Fabry's group, and lipid disorders were more common in the lopinavir group. So in summary, the results of this trial in naive subjects with advanced HIV disease show a significantly higher proportion of subjects achieving a goal of less than 50 copies at 48 weeks in the Fabry's arm by intent to treat analysis. The difference is highly significant in favor of efavirenz and is given both by the higher rate of virological failure in the lopinavir group as well as the higher rate of discontinuation. And it is important to note that the difference was not significant in the 400-copy assay, which implies that most failures in the lopinavir group are occurring with viral loads in the range between 50 and 400 copies. The other finding of the study confirms findings from other trials showing a higher impact on triglycerides with lopinavir-ritonavir regimens. Until we improve the capacity, we accept that the study has important limitations since the study was conducted only in Mexico. Results may not be generalized. However, similar results have been observed in other trials. While there was a relatively significant rate of abandonment observed, it was similar among groups and may be explained by many factors, such as the high proportion of subjects coming from marginalized areas. Another factor may be the use of ACT as the nucleoside backbone, which may be associated with higher toxicity, especially in patients with advanced disease. While this is an important limitation in a study such as this, this is also a true reflection of real life in many regions in the country. Genotypic resistance was not done at baseline, and however, this is not a standard practice currently in Mexico because of costs and low prevalence shown so far of primary resistance. The other factor is that we used lopinavir capsules, which may have contributed to a higher pill burden. So until we improve our capacity to detect HIV infections in earlier stages in those regions of the world in which HIV disease is presenting at such late stages, we will continue to face the challenges that involve treating this group of patients, and I think that new studies should focus also in this population. Thank you.
Thank you, Juan, for this excellent presentation, remarkably similar to the results of the 5142 study. I think we have Joel Gallant in the first microphone.
Joel Gallant from Baltimore. I may have missed it, but it looked like you were using a higher than standard dose of lopinavir ritonavir.
I didn't hear the question. We use the dose, 3 capsules, 2 times a day of lopinavir ritonavir. I'm sorry, I didn't put the acknowledgement slide and the funding from the study. And the study was funded by CONACYT Mexico in part, and by the Department of Infectious Disease of the Hospital of Nutrición, and by Instituto Mexicano del Seguro Social, in case people want to know.
Mike?
So I'm feeling very sparky this morning. I promise I won't ask any more questions. It was a very nice study. But I think it really is the hare and the tortoise is, do you want to have early virologic help, or do you want to have lots of resistance when you fail? My question is more related to the presentation of adverse events and the relationship between the fact that you see a higher CD4, it was non-statistically significant, but with the small sample size, and it was the same in ACGG5142. You get a better CD4 response with Kaletra, or sorry, lopinavir, ritonavir for those non-advertisers. And is that related to IRIS or to IRIS-like syndromes or even to the therapy of emergent mycobacterial disease? So did you have an imbalance between the arms or a proportion of patients who developed IRIS? And how do you think that relates to the CD4 rise?
That's a very interesting question. Unfortunately, we didn't plan the study to look for IRIS, and now we wish we would. But we were not, as you know, defining IRIS is so difficult, and you have to do it prospectively. In retrospectively, it would be very hard to go back and check for that. Thank you.
Richard?
Halbrick, San Diego. I was going to ask a question quibbling about the non-inferiority sample size calculation, since you had a much lower sample size than a superiority study that we did in ACTG5142, but I actually won't ask that question. Just a comment on the CD4 increase. I couldn't tell because numbers were small, but we saw about a 50-cell increase in the lopinavir-containing arms compared to the efavirenz arm across all the CD4 strata. Although statistically significant, we didn't see any difference when we looked for thresholds, i.e., did you get more patients above a critical threshold like 200? Did you do such an analysis to see if there were more patients that got above 200 cells between your two arms?
We didn't look it that way, but we can do it. And with respect to the sample size, I also agree that the study actually was powered with a higher number of patients originally to meet non-inferiority criteria. However, we had to stop recruiting for the study because of funding problems, and we proceeded with a study such as this, and we still found difference.
Okay, thank you, Juan. We are moving to our next presentation. I'm sorry, we have time for one more question. Yes.
Do you think using capsules for the lopinavir introduced a bias into the study compared to efavirenz that didn't have capsules, and there was pill burden, obviously, for the group that used the lopinavir?
The fact that we used capsules may obviously increase the pill burden for patients and probably have more problems with adherence. I don't think that the gastrointestinal problems would be different from the data that I've seen with the tablet formulation. So I don't think that would be a problem.
Thank you, Juan. We are moving to our next paper, and this will be resistant profile on patients failing first-line ART in Malawi when using clinical and immunological monitoring by Dr. Jose Nipur.
Thank you. I'd like to first thank the organizers for letting me stand up in this very big room and give the findings of our study, and I'm glad to present this on behalf of my fellow investigators. The Malawi antiretroviral program has now started over 150,000 patients on D4T3TC and nevirapine. As we know, over time, a substantial minority will have virologic failure and eventually clinical failure. In failing patients, resistance will be present. And today, there's few data from African settings with resistance patterns, particularly where clinical and immunologic monitoring is done. As we know, looking at failure, virologic failure occurs initially, and then progression to immunological and clinical failure will proceed. We also know from developed world settings that resistance accumulates to a degree over time. although virologic monitoring is primarily used in these settings. Given the combination that we're using, we can expect that the 184V will be one of the first mutations that will develop, followed by NNRTI mutations, and then cimetidine analog mutations, and we don't actually know what will be happening as we progress further along the continuum. The Malawi ART diagnosis is going to be made in the latest stages because they use immunologic and clinical diagnoses for failure. Our second line regimen in Malawi is tenofovir, zidovudine, 3TC, and lopinavir-ritonavir. And the success of this regimen depends on the number of active drugs at the time of starting the regimen, and this would depend on how much resistance had accumulated and the potency of the individual drugs. One thing fortunate is that lopinavir-ritonavir shouldn't have any resistance mutations in this setting. This was a prospective study of patients who were starting second-line antiretroviral in Malawi. And one of our objectives was to study the resistance patterns of patients failing first-line treatment. These were HIV-positive patients who were more than 13 years old, and they had been started on D4T, 3TC, nevirapine, although they may have changed to our alternative first-line, which includes zidovudine substitution in the event of D4T toxicity and efavirenz for nevirapine. It's a two-center study at the Lighthouse Clinic at Kamuzu Central Hospital and the Antiretroviral Clinic at Queen Elizabeth Central Hospital, which is in Blantyre. And our enrollment was from December 2005 to June 2007. The clinical ART failure definition for Malawi is a new WHO stage 4 condition or progressive stage 4 condition. And the immunologic ART definition is a greater than 50% decline from the peak or below pretreatment values. For our study, we confirmed antiretroviral failure with an RNA greater than 400, and we performed resistance testing if the viral load was greater than 1,000 copies. We used the TrueGen for genotype analysis and Monogram for the phenotype, and our mutations were defined per IAS USA guidelines. We had 96 patients who were identified as antiretroviral failure with a viral load of greater than 1,000 copies. 16 had met clinical failure definitions, and 87 had immunologic, and a number of them had both. 66 of our subjects were on D4T, 3TC, and nevirapine at the time of failure diagnosis, and 30 were on zidovudine and 3TC as they had developed D4T toxicity. Two of our samples didn't amplify, so we had 94 samples available for analysis. The characteristics of our patients at the time of failure, the median age was 38, CD4 was very low at 68, the viral load was 52,000, and the duration of antiretroviral treatment was 37 months, and we had 50% female. As you might expect, we had a high rate of the 184 mutations. 81% of the patients had this mutation. 93% of the patients had NNRTI mutations with a median of 2, and 181C, 190A, and 103N were the most common. We had wild-type virus in 5% of the samples. We had no patients who had only a 184V, and only 2% of patients had only NNRTI mutations. 16% had only 184V and NNRTI mutations. So for the other 77% of the patients that we saw, they had very complex regimens, and this is the, or complex mutations, and this is the group that we phenotyped as well. But 56% of the patients had TAMs. 23% of the patients had tenofovir mutations, the K65R and K70E, with the K65R occurring more frequently. 7% had both tenofovir and TAMs, and 19% of the patients had a Q151M complex. If you put this together, the people who had Q151M and tenofovir was 16%. We also had a patient with a 69 insertion. So based on these resistance patterns, you would expect that 17% of the patients would have pan-nucleoside resistance. Among the patients with TAMs, 28% had one, 28% had two, and 44% of the patient had three or more TAMs, with a 215, 67N, and 70R being the most common. We performed a multivariate analysis adjusting for sex, viral load, CD4 count, the use of AZT, and the type of failure to evaluate the emergence of K65R or 70E, and we found that having a very low CD4 count, less than 100 at the time of evaluation, had an increased risk of nearly sixfold for developing this mutation, and the presence of using AZT at the time of failure was associated with a marked decreased risk in the presence of these mutations. We did a similar analysis looking at the pan-NRTI resistance, and again found that having a low CD4 count at the time of failure diagnosis was associated with a nearly tenfold increased risk of failure or having these resistance mutations, and again AZT was protective. We also looked at the emergence of greater than three TAMs as an outcome, and again having a low CD4 count was associated with an increased risk, but in this case the use of AZT was associated with a higher risk of having three TAMs. When we looked at the ART backbones that might be chosen and whether there would be two fully active drugs, in our first column we have the samples that we actually did a phenotype on, and then this is our total sample with the assumption that those that did not have the complex mutations would probably be fully sensitive. But among two fully active drugs, emtricitabine and tenofovir would only have 2% with fully active drugs, abacavir, didanosine 1%, and zidovudine, lamivudine, tenofovir 21%. Looking at no fully active drugs, emtricitabine, tenofovir would be 29%, abacavir, didanosine would be 50%, and zidovudine, lamivudine, tenofovir would be 22%. And we use the lower limits of the monogram assay to be more conservative. Our limitations of our study are we did not include all virologically failing clients because we don't do viral load monitoring in our program. And we're also unable to know the exact duration of virologic failure for these patients because we don't do viral load monitoring. Using the lower CD4 count, we were estimating this might be a good surrogate for duration of failure. The circulating genotype at the time of failure might not represent archived resistance, such that those patients who had changed to AZT, had they been failing when on D4T, we may have had more K65R or 70E mutations. And the phenotype cut point for monogram actually applied to Clade B virus and might not be as useful for Clade C. And so we use the lower limit. Our conclusions is that extensive resistance is present at the time of ART failure when you use immunologic and clinical monitoring. 17% would be predicted to have no active NRTIs by genotype. AZT appears protective for the emergence of tenofovir and pan-nucleoside resistance mutations, but increases the risk of having greater than three TAMs at the time of failure diagnosis. 22 to 50% would have no fully active drugs by phenotype, depending on which NRTI backbone that you chose. And zidovudine, lamivudine, tenofovir, which is the choice of Malawi, actually was the most likely to have two active drugs and the least likely of having no active drugs. In settings where clinical and immunologic monitoring is used, predominantly with stavidine-based first-line treatment, it seems that zidovudine, lamivudine, tenofovir is the most likely combination to have active drugs, and abacavir didanosine probably shouldn't be recommended as an empiric backbone to change to in these settings. I'd like to acknowledge all of my colleagues and also especially the Malawi National AIDS Commission, who funded the majority of this study, and Monogram Sciences, who supported the phenotypes.
Thank you very much for this really interesting study. We are lacking studies about resistance in the developing world, so I think this is a very important contribution to this conference. So the floor is open for questions or discussions. Microphone two over there.
Thanks, Ben, for that very wonderful presentation.
Microphone, please.
My name is Arthur Mitaiwo from Northwestern. I have a couple of questions. Can you comment on the recent Lancet paper published by Phillips and others? Can you comment on the recent Lancet paper published by Phillips and others in which they basically did mathematical modeling and concluded that virologic monitoring was not really that important to resource-limited settings? And secondly, I would like to suggest that your the conclusion that AZT is protective is probably right, but you have to look at it in the context of duration of duration on stavidine, because all the patients tried on stavidine and then they were switched to zidovudine. So people on zidovudine spent were those who were on stavidine for a shorter duration of time, and so you have to correct for the duration of time of duration of treatment on stavidine before we can make that conclusion that zidovudine was protected.
Thank you for your comment. David?
David Cooper, Sydney. I agree, these are very compelling data, and they're starting to emerge from other regions like Asia as well, so I think it's a global phenomenon. What I'd like to ask you are the implications for guidelines, because if the guidelines continue to recycle nucleosides which have a very high chance of not working, that's just going to increase toxicity and not provide a very happy outcome for second line. So I'd be interested in what you feel about that.
I don't know if I was supposed to comment on the first speaker about the paper, so I'll mention that. That actually their estimates on the modeling did closely predict the percentage of NNRTI and 184 mutations, but I think it slightly underestimates the K65R and the tenofovir mutations. So there might be some problems with the model, and I guess I'll chat with somebody at some point about that. As far as implications, I think that probably we're lucky that we're using lopinavir or ritonavir as the protease inhibitor because it has such great potency. And I think as we look at the efficacy outcomes of this study, since we've been following the patients since they started second line, we can stratify according to their level of resistance at the time. And if we see that there's particularly good response in the patients, then studies potentially looking at lopinavir or ritonavir monotherapy or alternatively looking at a new class of drugs in combination with lopinavir, ritonavir might be better for second line to actually empirically add another class of drugs. Since this particular strategy does seem to develop a lot of resistance. Viral load monitoring has to eventually become in the forefront of how we're going to manage these people, and I don't mean necessarily the standard HIV RNA that we do, but really coming up with a feasible method of monitoring viral load needs to be a part of treatment in developing countries. And I think that most of the posters that I've looked at, and we're all coming to the same conclusion that you need viral load monitoring to some degree in order to really be able to prevent this emergence of resistance and preserve NRTI agents for future use.
Mark?
Mark Weinberg, McGill University, Montreal. I enjoyed your study very much and commend you for the thoroughness of the analysis. One question is that you have obviously shown us that K65R seems to be appearing with somewhat higher frequency in a Malawi population than might be the case elsewhere. But you did not tell us if it is appearing in the context of particular nucleosides. So can you add any information in terms of specific drugs potentially being able to select out 65R in the context of the analysis?
In our study, actually, all of the K65Rs except for two were in patients that had been on stavidine. We didn't have, and the two patients who had it were only 1 month and 4 months on AZT treatment at the time that we evaluated them. So it seems that it's very clearly stavidine that is selecting for this K65R.
So I would simply point out that that is consistent with data that we reported earlier with colleagues from Botswana, and I think we should perhaps stop referring to K65R as a tenofovir-related mutation and understand that it is really a mutation that is selected by multi-nucleosides, especially perhaps in the context of subtype C viruses.
Okay, we have no more time for questions, so we will move on to our last paper. And this paper will be presented by Susan Cox and co-workers, Safety Profile of Aprecitabine, a Novel Nucleoside During 24 Weeks Dosing in Experienced HIV-1 Infected Patients.
...in the workplace, commercial practice, and institutions. This is ultimately the example of a functional agreement, if somewhat extreme from a Swiss perspective, between rights and duties. In any case,
thank you. Well, I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for this opportunity to present the safety data on aprecitabine. I feel that safety and tolerability is an important point for us to consider. We do need new active agents, but we also need agents that are safe and well tolerated, because poorly tolerated agents are difficult to adhere to and also have a great impact on the quality of life of patients. So this presentation will focus on the safety profile of aprecitabine, which is a novel NRTI during a 24-week dosing period in experienced HIV-infected patients. Some background on aprecitabine. It's a deoxycytidine analog, and it's a new NRTI, which has a very promising profile in patients who are resistant to other NRTIs. And I think the previous speaker has given us some very fine illustrations of the need for new NRTIs which have activity against the common NRTI resistance mutations that occur in failing patients. Previous data on the efficacy of aprecitabine have been presented, firstly at the IAS meeting last year in Sydney, where data on a 21-day period of monotherapy were presented, showing that ATC provided approximately a 0.8 log drop as a monotherapy in experienced patients who are failing therapy. This was followed up this year by a presentation at CROI, where a poster was presented on the 24-week data, showing that aprecitabine was able to result in 70% of patients having less than 50 copies after 24 weeks, and a rise in CD4 cells of over 250 cells. So those antiviral data are all available, and I won't focus too much on this talk on the antiviral data, although I believe they are extremely promising. So this talk will focus more on the safety and tolerability data. The preclinical data that we have on aprecitabine suggests that it should have a very good profile. It has a very low propensity for mitochondrial, hepatic, or bone marrow toxicity, all of which can be concerns with this NRTI class. We also have good activity in the presence of the 184 mutation, which, as you've heard earlier, is an extremely common mutation, on its own or when accompanied by other TAMs or other NAMs in the reverse transcriptase. The study design of the 201 study, patients were failing their current regimen with the presence of 184V. They may also have had other mutations, and I'll go on to tell you about that in the next 1,000 and CD4 cells of greater than 50. They were randomized either to receive 600 or 800 milligrams of ATC or to continue on 3TC in a blinded fashion.
So initially there was a 21-day period of this functional monotherapy during which we were able to establish the absolute contribution of apositabine as the sole change in those patients. And under those conditions, it provided approximately a 0.8 log decrease at day 21. At day 21, all patients had their background therapy optimized according to the genotype at screening, and they then continued on to week 24. At week 24, all patients were offered open-label ATC, and then they continued on to week 48. And we expect to present the week 48 efficacy data at a future conference later this year. The data I present to you now is the safety and tolerability data at week 24, comparing the two ATC arms and the 3TC arm. The baseline characteristics are shown here in this slide. As you can see, we had a mean age of around 40. Around a third of the patients were female, which is encouraging. We had a few patients with an initial viral load of over 100,000, as you can see there, but not many. And then, as I mentioned, at baseline, we had roughly half of the patients who, in addition to the 184V mutation, had one or two TAMs. And around the rest of the patients, around half of the patients, had 184V with three or more TAMs at baseline. The initial presentation of the summary of adverse events up to week 24 is shown here. And you can see that for the ATC arms, there were some patients who did not report any adverse events at all up to 24 weeks, whereas none of the patients in the 3TC arm achieved this. The overall presentation is fairly similar, as you can see. The exception is that slightly more patients reported grade 3 or 4 or severe AEs in the 3TC arm. And we also had three patients who reported serious AEs in the 3TC arm compared to none of the patients on any of the ATC doses. We did not have any patients withdrawing from the study due to AEs, although, as noted, one patient in the 600 milligram ATC arm did withdraw at week 20 owing to pregnancy. Looking at the absolute number of adverse events occurring up to week 24, again, you can see it's fairly similar between the two ATC arms and the 3TC arm. Most of the AEs were mild or moderate in nature, as you can see. There were slightly more severe AEs in the 3TC arm than in the ATC arms. And again, we had five serious adverse events occurring in the 3TC arm compared to none at all in either of the ATC doses. The treatment-related AEs and the SAEs, we had five patients who reported eight adverse events that were determined by the investigator to be possibly or probably related to ATC. We had a mild diarrhea and mild dizziness in one patient on the 600 milligram dose, mild nausea in one patient on the 600 milligram dose, and that patient did temporarily interrupt study drug, although then restarted without further problems. We had a mild pyrosis on 800 milligrams, mild anorexia and moderate weight loss on 800 milligrams, and a mild gastric intolerance and moderate diarrhea in the 800 milligram group. Three patients reported five AEs that were possibly or probably related to 3TC, mild nausea and vomiting, and mild increase in lipoatrophy in one patient, mild facial lipoatrophy in a second patient, and a moderate and then a severe exacerbation of peripheral neuropathy occurred in a third patient in the 3TC arm. As mentioned, we had three patients who reported five serious adverse events. They were all unrelated, but they all occurred in the 3TC arm. We had a left renal calculus that occurred at week 16. We had a patient with renal insufficiency, and we had a patient that experienced a dental abscess at week 10. looking across the most frequent AEs that were treatment emergent between day 0 and week 24. Again, you can see the three arms are quite similar. The pattern of adverse events is probably what you would expect in this treatment experienced population who are also receiving other antivirals. So we do have representation, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. There are some raised triglycerides, raised cholesterol. There's some dyspepsia and a few headaches. And again, this is pretty much what you would expect of this population of patients and was similar across the arms. So finally, to conclude, apricitabine was safe and very well tolerated over 24 weeks in combination with other background antiretrovirals. The safety profile of ATC was at least as good as that of 3TC. Importantly, we see no evidence of any peripheral neuropathy, myelotoxicity, hepatic toxicity, no increase in lactate, lipids, no increase in lipase, pancreatitis, no rash, no hypersensitivity, and no renal toxicity from ATC. And all of these, as you know, can be complications with other drugs. So we feel that as a second-line treatment for treatment-experienced patients, and I think you've heard in the previous talk how important it is that we have available new drugs for treatment-experienced patients. We believe ATC provides not only very good antiviral activity, but an excellent safety and tolerability profile. So I'd just like to finish by thanking all the investigators and the patients and the study staff and all the folk back in Melbourne at AveXa who've worked so hard on this study, and I thank you for your attention.
Is there any question? Thank you, Susan, and we thank all the speakers for this very nice session we had this morning, and we look forward to seeing you in the rest of the conference. Thank you very much.